Working on the Modern Church History class for Foundation Institute, and by the way, I've got the latest scuttlebutt so far, says the class will go online March 1st now, so it's pushed back a couple of weeks to give the media team time to put things together. But working on the Modern Church History class for Foundation Institute has proven a real opportunity for both my wife and for me. While we both have a long history in the Church of God since our much younger days, there was still much that we've learned in going through all of this material. And now I've got to go back and try to coordinate it all and get it in a correct order related to the classes. I've got about three notebooks about like this that have stuff I've printed out, and that doesn't even count what I have online in files. That the things that we've covered, especially, I've learned at least the most, I think, about those who went before us from nearly 100 years ago now and before that, going back as the class does. The focus of the class starts in the early 1800s, right at the beginning of the 19th century. And we've learned, I think both of us would say, I think my wife would agree, we've learned just how amazing the promise Jesus Christ made to his church really was in Matthew 16:18. He said there, the gates of Hades, meaning the grave, would never prevail against it. We've always understood clearly what that had to mean, that it would never die out. And yet, as we've discovered, there are variations in how much understanding the people had at any one time. Somewhere, even in times of great spiritual darkness in the world, there had to be some of the called out ones who were refusing to cave in, refusing to compromise, refusing to be deceived or re-deceived in some cases. It reminds me a little bit of the events in the days of Elijah, when he was so instrumental in standing up for God among the people of the ancient nations of Israel and Judah, and the incident on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. You may recall the incident. We've stood on that mountain. We've seen a statue that's been erected in his honor, and he looks pretty fearsome. I wouldn't have wanted to mess with him, I'll tell you that. At least the statue did. And we know where the brook Kishon is, down at the base of the hill, where apparently they took the prophets and executed them. It was a gruesome time back then in so many ways. But the bottom line is, then the next chapter, if you read the various accounts, he's fleeing for his life from Queen Jezebel, who basically sent a message that said, I'm going to make your life about like the life of one of those prophets real soon. And he took off. And you know the story about how God, in a way, spoke to him. There was this mighty wind. There was all the power of nature unveiled right in front of him, the powers of weather that God could release at will. And then it said, but God wasn't in those things. And finally, there was a still, small voice that God spoke to Elijah. And basically, he just asked him, he said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he launched into, well, I've been so, you know, faithful, I've been so, you know, forceful, and I've given out my all in your service and this and that, and now they seek my life. And then there's a little more time goes by, and then the question comes back again, what are you doing here, Elijah? And the whole thing's repeated several times. And finally, right toward the end of the exchange, God gives him a to-do list. Okay, I want you to go do this. I want you to go anoint this king over Syria. I want you to do this. I want you to find Elisha and appoint him to your office as a prophet. I want you to do this. I want you to do this. I want you to do this. And oh, by the way, there are 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed the knee to Baal. 7,000. Because Elijah kept saying, and I alone am left. And I alone am left. And God would say, at the end, there are 7,000, Elijah, that you don't know about. Something like that is what we've discovered. The class material we cover is roughly over the last two centuries, or maybe just a bit more. We go back in the main part of the class to the early 1800s. Even in that relatively modern time, hence the title of the class, it's not always easy to ferret out where those true Christians were and can be found. It's a little bit like Dr. Guy's sermonette. We can only give an approximation from when Christ was born, because we can only say, well, it couldn't have been any earlier than this. And you can go by the shepherds in the field thing. They couldn't have been any later than about middle of October, because after that they brought them in. We have a window. That's about all we can say. And it's a little bit like that in looking for those that God was working with. Historically, the best thing to do is to start looking for Sabbath keepers, because that's an obvious thing to find. That was something that stood out in the religious environment of most of those history periods. After the push for a first day observance that really culminated in the 4th century with a couple or three of the councils and the statements by the bishop at Rome, who has come to be called the Pope, the Pontifex Maximus. That title actually belonged to the Roman emperors at first, and then it sort of settled onto the popes as well. But when you start looking, you'll find Sabbath keepers, and they're usually described as heretics or Judaizers or something like that by the established churches. And that's where we begin. But we also know that not all who know or knew that the seventh day is God's holy time or Sabbath, or his true Sabbath, and some of them who know it's the Sabbath don't understand the concept of holy time very well either. I've talked to a young man, well, he was young then, about 40 years ago, whose grandfather had worked in Oregon with Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and he was baptized as a member of that church, and we were just talking. He wanted to meet a minister of what was then, I was pastor for the Worldwide Church of God at the time in the early 80s, and so I said, oh, are you a member of this church? He said, yes, my grandfather baptized me. I said, oh, it's kind of tough with the Sabbath. He says, yeah, well, I do have to work on the Sabbath, but I am a member of the church. And excuse me. And so sometimes the understanding isn't really there. And of course, God knows those who are his, as Paul wrote to Timothy. But that's where we start. Any truly converted member of the Church of God will be a Sabbath keeper. That's a baseline. The palindromic look at it isn't always true. It isn't always true that those who acknowledge that the Sabbath is Saturday, sunset Friday to sunset Saturday, not all those are truly converted Christians. They just happen to know what day they should meet on. And sometimes that's as far as it goes. But in Romans 8 and verse 9, we read these words, "But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit dwells in you." Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, which is the same as the Spirit of God, they are united, he is not his. So that statement in Romans 8, 9 really informs our search, to put it one way. But there is an interesting message in the Bible that I find I haven't spoken about for quite some time. I was thinking, you know, I gave a sermon quite similar to this just a few years ago, and then I looked it up in my notes. Try 16 years ago. And sometimes it just kind of gets away from us. That message has probably intrigued many of you, and it does give a few more clues. It says it's actually a message to that church. It's really an entire book of the New Testament when you understand it one way. But there is a more specific part of it that really zooms in on, really homes in on God's people. The entire last book of the Bible is our source. The book of Revelation, not Revelations. I hear that stated sometimes. It doesn't say that. It's just singular as far as the title of the book, although it has a number of revelations in it. It just means revealing or opening, that God wanted his people to understand these things. But it's pretty specific. The very first words of the book, Revelation 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. Now, I can read those words in English. My Greek is terrible. I have trouble with the alphabet in Greek. That's pretty basic. The ABCs, the alphabeta gammas of the Greek. I know it has 22 letters. I'm not sure what they did with the other four, but that's what they have. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John. And this person, this servant, John, the last of the apostles, bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ to all things that he saw. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Now, when we read those words, think about who wrote them, the human instrument who wrote them. How old was John at this point in time? He was in his 90s. Do you think for him the time was near? I think it was, if you wanted an appointment with him, you better make sure it's quick. And so, from that perspective, it was certainly near in the life of the one who penned the words. And from God's perspective, we know from the verses that Peter wrote, it says, to God, a day is as 1,000 years. And 1,000 years, when it is past, is like a day. You know, you think in terms of God's not being able to converse with his friend Abraham. How long has that gone on for God? About 4 days, from his perspective. So it's different. But who is this to? And then John says in verse 4, John to the seven churches which are in Asia. Grace to you and peace from him who is and was and is to come, and from the seven spirits before his throne. From Jesus, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead. Firstborn implies what? There are others to come. And the ruler over the kings of the earth, to him who loved us, and so on and so forth. And he talks about the future. Verse 7 talks about he is coming with clouds, and every eye will see him, even they who pierced him. Well, eventually they will. They won't. Those who literally did it won't see him when he returns, because of course they'll still be asleep in their graves awaiting the second resurrection, 1,000 years forward from that day of his return. It talks about the tribes of the earth will mourn. As you read through the events of Revelation, it might be worth dwelling on in your mind what it will take to reduce our world and its population to the point they will finally accept and yield to the rule of Jesus Christ. It's going to be quite the time. But there are so many things to consider here. It's almost a coded message because it's written to show his servants the things which shall shortly take place. The verse I read to you from Romans 8:9 identifies those people, the ones in whom God's Spirit dwells. That ties into John 6:44, how God draws and calls those to himself. It's a rather select list. Specific list at this time. The message to those seven churches that he refers to are in chapters 2 and 3. Now, there have been so many ways, there are different ways, three different ways specifically, of looking at this message. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. There is the literal interpretation to the people who lived at the time that John wrote the book of Revelation. There was a handful, a small audience, who read those words then. There is what we might call the historical understanding. God's people down through the history of the New Testament time. And there's what I would call the universal application, meaning the message to all seven churches can apply to all of the addressees of the book, all of God's people at all times. All three ways are valid. They all teach us something. And as far as I know, in my time in God's church, which goes back further than I care to think about sometimes, we've always taught in God's church that each one of these ways is biblically sound and a good way to view the message to the seven churches. But today I want to get a little more specific. Where am I going with this? Which of these seven churches do we relate to the most? Let me ask you that. Which of these seven do we relate to the most? Do you have an answer to that? Where might that take us? I'm guessing you probably answered Philadelphia, the sixth of the seven churches. Why did you say that, if you did? Well, that's a little bit where I want to get into our topic today, but just to get into it, that's not where I want to end up. I imagine if you said that, you had a reason. After all, we can't apply the literal understanding since we don't live back then when John wrote. So that's out. We usually identify with the historical application with good reason. The end is obviously much nearer, that is, the return of Christ is much nearer than what he described in those early verses of chapter 1 than when he wrote the book. And Philadelphia is the sixth of the seven churches. We see in our desire to do God's work, in our historical efforts to do that work, a fulfilling of the message to Philadelphia about an open door. One of the things that has become just blazingly clear to me in researching for this class is how much different a certain defined period of time was in the history of God's church over the last 200 years. I've taken a look at it from in a fair amount of detail from 1800 on to where we are now. And I can see a radical difference beginning, I'll just pick a time because this is where it begins to show, in about the 1930s or early 1940s, in terms of responses, in terms of numbers reached, in terms of growth, in terms of ability to proclaim a message, etc., etc. And then I see in about the 1990s and forward a decline in those numbers, in that effort, in that effectiveness. That just happens to correlate almost exactly with the history of what was first called the Radio Church of God, later the Worldwide Church of God, until sometime after that fall-off began, that actually changed its name and is now indistinguishable from a typical Protestant evangelical church. It's interesting from a historical perspective, and of course that was driven in large measure by the ministry of one individual by the name of Herbert W. Armstrong. Not perfect, but certainly used in a very powerful way. There's a lot in here to think about. We also, I would say, in Revelation 2 and 3, aspire to, at least, the universal application, because we like the character we see portrayed from Philadelphia. But we're aware that we ought to be warned by the messages to all seven of the churches. As I mentioned, it's not always clear in studying the history of some of these people what they understood. As I got into some of the material in the early 1800s, as I watched a time period where understanding was deteriorating in the records that I could find of the Church of God, I saw a group that didn't understand who they were in terms of Revelation 2 and 3. It was not uncommon for members and ministers at the time to identify themselves, interestingly enough, as Laodicean. I'm not quite sure why that was, perhaps because it was the last of the seven. As you read the messages, there is language in the message to the seven churches to the last four that seem to possibly indicate that elements of the last four will be present at the return of Christ. Yes, even with Thyatira and Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea. You have to dig for it, but it's there. The first three seem to be clearly, as some researchers call it, fully ancestral. That is, nobody here in that group anymore. But it's interesting as you start looking at it all. I found another group, more sort of adjacent to the time period I've described, who, at least officially, don't subscribe to the theory of the historical application of these verses. They don't see themselves as being any one of the seven, and in fact, they would identify themselves. They actually pick a year and an individual. They say, our church, our fellowship began in the year 1858 with a man by the name of Gilbert Cranmer in Michigan. That's the way they identify it. And yet, it was among that group that the explosion began to come from the ministry of one of their ministers who was a licensed minister of that group for 7 years. So it's interesting as you look at it all. But as we look at some of these messages to the churches, you look at the summation of each one. The first one is Ephesus, and in Revelation 2:7 it says, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches," all of them, but this is specifically to Ephesus. "To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God." These are all references that can be understood to be part of God's family. Smyrna, verse 11, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death." That's perhaps something of a comfort to those people because their whole time period is described as persecution. Pergamos, the third one, talks about in verse 17, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it." That seems to indicate like a place setting at a formal meal. You've seen perhaps formal meals where the guest names are put out in a place setting. Thyatira, verse 25 says, "Hold fast what you have till I come." Interesting. "And he who overcomes and keeps my works till the end, to him I will give power over the nations. He'll rule them with a rod of iron. They'll be dashed to pieces like the potter's vessels, as I've received from my Father. And I'll give him the morning star. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Sardis, summary is, in verse 4 of chapter 3, "You have a few names, even in Sardis, who have not defiled their garments." They didn't have a completely above board description. "He who overcomes will be clothed in white garments. I will not blot his name out from the book of life. I'll confess his name before my Father and the angels. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Philadelphia, verse 11 of chapter 3. "Behold, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he'll go out no more. I'll write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I'll write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." And the last one, Laodicea. Verse 19, he says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore, be zealous and repent. I stand at the door and knock." That seems to be an imminent reference. Close. "If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him, and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Those are the messages. You notice anything in common with them all? They all have the same phrase at one point. "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." All of them. So this can be understood as a message back then to the people who read it in John's day. Historically, through various developments and ages and eras of that church, we honestly believe there's a case to be made for that, and always have, in my knowledge anyway. And a universal application for all those God has called out. There's something to be gleaned from the messages to every one of those seven churches. But in looking closely, which one or ones do we want to make sure we're not like? Well, we'd probably start looking for the, and analyzing, you know, weighing this on the scales of justice, whatever you want to call it, what their evaluation was from God. Well, we certainly wouldn't want to leave our first love like Ephesus. We wouldn't want to endure almost nonstop persecution like Pergamos. We wouldn't want to have some of the issues with Pergamos. You know, you dwell where Satan's throne is and you've been influenced by it. We don't like that sound. Thyatira seems like they had two works. There was one that was important, and then there was this kind of a lull in between, and then it picks up again, and then they're encouraged just to hang on. Sardis talks about they have a name that they're alive, but there's some spiritual dead wood there, and that's not helpful. It even says, you have a few in Sardis which have not defiled their garments. What does that mean? We'd say, I don't really want to be there. Okay, I really like Philadelphia. Philadelphia is my team. Now, we're not talking football. It's nothing about the Eagles and the NFL playoffs right now, so just scratch that. We're just talking about a spiritual application. And then Laodicea, we say, ugh, I don't want to be that one. I mean, Laodicean? That's kind of been a pejorative description in the church in all the years I've known, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. Some of them seem definitely, we don't want to be part of. Others are a mixed bag, but there's one, and you know which one I'm driving at. Isn't the really bad apple in this barrel almost always picked to be the last one, Laodicea? I think that's the way many in God's church have tended to see it, and I'm not gainsaying that. There's some serious difficulties in the message to the church at Laodicea. But I wonder, have we, as God's people, sometimes spent too much time trying to figure out who is Laodicean instead of really gleaning the most from the message to the Laodiceans? In other words, maybe we've not been very discerning in how best to apply this part of the message in our day and age and in our lives. How can we do that? The message is clear that these messages, all of them, are to all the churches. There's something to learn for all of us. To any of us who have been around God's church for any length of time, the term Laodicean definitely has a very strong and very unpleasant connotation. I remember at the time my wife and I were attending Ambassador College many, many moons ago. There was a campus newspaper that was called The Portfolio. It was all a take on the concept. Ambassador College, of course, was a take on the reference by Paul to being ambassadors for Jesus Christ. And the college yearbook was called The Envoy. And the college little circular newspaper was called The Portfolio. So all of it played off on that concept of an ambassador, a representative of a foreign government in a different country. Well, in The Portfolio, they had this regular cartoon feature. And in some of the Church of God newspapers, they had this regular feature, and it was called Laodicean Jones. And he was a cartoon figure, and Laodicean Jones was always doing something wrong. He was always in trouble for some reason. It was Laodicean Jones. I don't know why they picked on poor Jones, but they did. I was grateful it wasn't Laodicean Johnson, because that's a fairly common last name in this country, too. But at any rate, that's the way it's been since I can remember. It seems like it always had a strong and unpleasant connotation. Some, sadly, have engaged in the old human tendency of finger-pointing at others, pronouncing other individuals, or in the last few decades, 25, 30 years, even having some groups point at everybody else and say, you're all Laodicean and we're the only true Philadelphians. That's happened in some cases, too. How discerning is that, is my question. Wouldn't it be more profitable for all of us to ask, what is Laodicean? Instead of, who is Laodicean? That's what I'd like to try to do today in the time that's left. In doing that, maybe we can develop more of the qualities of Philadelphia ourselves as we relate to others in God's church. So I guess what we're really asking is, what is the Laodicean problem? What is Laodicean? Laodicea was one, as we know, we've just seen it, of seven churches in Western Asia Minor at the time that Christ gave this message of the book of Revelation to John when he was on the Isle of Patmos. Christ told John that all of the messages were to be applied to all of the churches. It was true that each church received a unique message, but he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches is repeated seven times. Well, it's stated once and repeated six more, appears seven times. But the entire prophecy was sent to those churches in Asia Minor. That was in Revelation 1 and verse 11. The entire prophecy was sent. It says, he said, I am the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last. What you see, write in a book and send it to the seven churches which are in Asia, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. Revelation 1:11. The entire thing sent to them all. There can be no doubt Revelation is an end-time book in one sense. Its message is for what one translator years ago called the crisis at the close. That's an old translation by James Moffat that you don't see much anymore. It contains instructions for all Christians. Revelation 1:3 we read at the beginning, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep the things written in it, for the time is near. That's to everybody. The Laodicean church, as you read the message to Laodicea in chapter 3, is not rejected. It doesn't say, you aren't God's people. It just says, here are your problems that you really need to work on. What's interesting is how much was drawn on the background of the city of Laodicea at the time itself. I mean, there are certain references. We draw the bad vibes, of course, from the reference to the works not being cold or hot in verse 15. It talks about, I will spew you in the Old King James, or vomit you out of my mouth because you're neither cold nor hot. And their own response was, I'm rich, I've become wealthy, I have need of nothing, and you don't even know, he says, that you're wretched, miserable, poor, and blind, and naked. Spiritually, those things are devastating. And here's my advice. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire that you may be rich, and white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. Anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. Those very things are uniquely geared to Laodicea from the city's historical background. And that's what made this interesting. And he does say, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten or discipline, be zealous and repent. And he urges them, he said, I'm standing at the door and I'm knocking. Open the door. As a side point, my wife and I had kind of a scary encounter coming home from Virginia. The Lamberts took us to, they had booked a hotel for us very close to the Norfolk Airport that had a 24-hour shuttle service because our flight was very early. We actually had to leave for the airport at 4 a.m. At 3:30, well, we were already up and getting ready, but there was a huge commotion in the hallway, loud banging on the doors, foul language, threats being hurled, and clearly there was somebody either very drunk or very much under the influence of alcohol. We called down to the desk, and I'm sure others did too. The police had to respond. I've certainly heard of domestic violence, which this appears to have been, but in a hotel, an upscale good hotel. This was a Marriott property. It wasn't, you know, a fly-by-night thing. And we had to wait in our room. They called, said, stay in your room until the police give us the clearance, because it was on our floor. It was just down the hall. It's kind of scary when you walk out of your hotel room and there are six police officers in the hallway and there are more in the lobby. I stand at the door and knock. That had a meaning to us. Also, praying for protection in our travels certainly came to have a meaning as well. I can't imagine what Mr. Meeker goes through on his trips, as I'm sure some of you have read those itineraries. But at any rate, this is the message to Laodicea. They're not rejected, but they surely are strongly counseled to change. Nobody would have wanted to hear something like that as an evaluation from God. And yet, that doesn't mean he'd already rejected them. He's pleading with them because they're his children, and he loves them, and he wants them in his family. They were, of course, in serious spiritual condition. Nobody would dispute that. But they were given the opportunity to change. And if they would repent, they were promised a share in the same destiny that awaits all faithful Christians. Actually, that verse 21 in chapter 3 is one of the most often repeated and quoted scriptures we can give to talk about our future service in God's kingdom. And it's in the message to Laodicea. To him who overcomes, I'll grant to sit with me on my throne as I overcame and sat with my Father on his. That describes what we understand our first job to be in the kingdom as part of those, as co-administrators of the government of God with Jesus Christ. And when we realize that even the shocking and sobering part of Christ's message to Laodicea applied to the church of God through the ages, let's see what we can learn. What was their problem? Well, literally, what was their problem? Well, there are four repetitions of really a singular theme. But let me give you some background from the city itself. Apparently, John drew on some well-known facts of the day. Nelson's Bible Dictionary says, in 62 BC, Flaccus seized the annual contribution of the Jews of Laodicea for Jerusalem, amounting to 20 pounds of gold. 20 pounds of gold. Even in today's reckoning, that's not bad. Holman's Bible Dictionary says, the extent of its wealth is illustrated by the fact that Laodicea was rebuilt without the financial help of Rome after a disastrous earthquake in the year AD 60. They basically said, I'm rich, I have become wealthy, and I have need of nothing. That's what they said to Rome. It's as almost as if John was reading from a series of memos from Laodicea to Rome. Laodicea earned its wealth in the textile industry and the production of black wool. I counsel you, what kind of garments? Black wool, and in the banking industry. Laodicea was known for its medical school, its school of ophthalmology, which concocted a spikenard balm for the treatment of the ears and an eye salve. An eye salve. The major weakness of Laodicea geographically was its lack of a water supply. This need was met by bringing water 6 miles north from Denizli through a system of stone pipes, which was another sign of the wealth. Water conveyed to Laodicea through these pipes was tepid by the time it reached the city. It was not hot, like from hot springs. It was not cold, as from a deep, deep well of cold water or a fast-running stream. By the time it got there, it was lukewarm, no matter which direction it came from. You know, Jesus Christ, he was the quintessential teacher. How many times did he take circumstances and situations and events around the people he talked to teach them lessons? The eye salve was called collyrium, and that was probably a reference, they think, to how it was applied. It was in the form of a poultice or a plaster that would be placed on the eye to try to draw the poisons out. The first illustration was given here is the wealth. The wealth that I've talked about. Because you say, I am rich. Wealth wasn't the problem. Was Jesus criticizing them because they were wealthy? No. The father of the faithful, Abraham, was for his day quite wealthy. That wasn't the issue. Solomon started off very well, and he was probably the wealthiest in terms of comparison to the other population of the rest of the population of the earth that we could think of. That wasn't the issue. They had, as a city, suffered a devastating loss, an earthquake that pretty much leveled the city. Disaster forced them to rebuild. The fact that they did that without any outside help was to their credit and commendable. The problem was that their wealth allowed them to feel self-sufficient or self-reliant. We don't need anybody else's help. What does that translate to you and to me in spiritual terms? It doesn't sound good, does it? Christ may have been quoting somebody when he inspired these words for John to write, "I am. You say, I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing." That may have been part of an official communique. Who knows? From Laodicean officials to the officials of Rome who offered to help rebuild the city. And the response was, we've got this. We don't need your help. Now, that would have been music to the ears of the Roman authorities. Great, we don't have to spend money on rebuilding Laodicea. But what did it say about them? They're not necessarily arrogant if you put it in that context. But the city faced the need to recover from a disaster and did it. That's not bad. We don't know why they did. Maybe they were afraid that if they accepted Roman help, they would be under Rome's thumb a little more. We don't know. And certainly the Jews had a history of revolting. Masada, you think of Masada, and some of the awful things that happened in history roughly around that time or a little later. We know that they didn't rebel from or withdraw from the Empire of Rome. In other words, they remained citizens of the kingdom. Isn't that interesting? The kingdom of Rome in this case. Laodiceans, spiritually, would still consider themselves to be citizens of which kingdom? But if the attitude is one of self-sufficiency, I don't need help, is that a good thing? Especially in our relationship with God. Why did Christ refer to their wealth in his warning? He used it as a teacher would. He used it as a lesson. Because the spiritual lesson is that spiritual independence is not a strength. Spiritual independence is not a strength. You know, Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he said in 1 Corinthians 12:21, I'll just quote it to you, Christians can't say, I have no need of some other part of the body. Remember that section in 1 Corinthians 12? I don't need. He said, well, wait a minute. Can the eye say, I don't need the ear? Can the hand say, because, you know, no, we can't do that. His point was, as the body of Christ, we're all essential and have to work together. We have to be interdependent, not independent. It's interesting that in history, Laodiceans didn't deny their Roman citizenship, only their need for dependence upon Rome. Again, that has overtones. Spiritual Laodiceans don't deny God or depart from the fundamental beliefs of the church, but a spiritual quality of Laodiceanism doesn't depend entirely on God for the help needed. That's the concern. Whatever the reasons, Laodiceans back then were people who were more comfortable relying on themselves to recover from disaster than in being dependent on others or interdependent with others. They're not the embodiment of evil or the personification of unfaithfulness. They're just people who rely on their own resources. But that can be a problem. Can be a problem. What's the next one we could pick? Well, how about Laodicean clothing? You know, I guess you could title these all Laodicean wealth, Laodicean clothing. It illustrates the same problem. Did Jesus Christ criticize them for their prosperous textile industry? That's what there was in the city. They were well known for their production of black wool. It was a special kind of cloth. It was used in certain ways that was especially useful to those who were well off. And physically, it helped build the city financially. Their dependence on it. What was a physical strength, but it gave Jesus Christ, in inspiring this message through John, another potential teaching tool about a spiritual weakness. What is clothing symbolic of throughout God's Word, especially in the New Testament? It's symbolic of righteousness. And in fact, in the same book of Revelation, we know that we read in Revelation 19:8, it says, To her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Christ's parables talked about wedding guests who came without the appropriate garments on. Clothing is symbolic. What are we supposed to do when we need God's help and strength? We are to put on the armor of the Spirit, the armor of God. We're to put on the armor of light, Paul calls it, interestingly enough, in Romans 13. The armor of light contrasted with the dark side. And we're not talking about movies here now. The theme of light versus darkness appears throughout the New Testament. Being children of light, 2 Corinthians 6. When Paul wrote to some of his charges, those he was teaching, he wrote in Colossians 3, he urged them to, as he said, put on the new man, Colossians 3 and verse 10. The Greek word that's used, that he used, enduo, E-N-D-U-O, is the same word that's used for putting on clothing in typical usage in Greek at the time. Put on the new man, it's like putting on clothes. Righteousness is described in the context of interacting with, putting up with, getting along with other people. Putting up with each other. It's not in pulling back from the body. Pulling away from sinful influences, of course, but not righteousness. Again, in writing to the Colossians, I cited Colossians 3, verse 10, but look at, you keep your place in Revelation, perhaps, but Colossians 3, verses 11 to 14, read this way. There is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free, but Christ is all and in all. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you must do. Above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. That's what Paul was talking about. Spirit-led Christians are making positive contributions to the body of Christ. They don't pull back from it into isolation. It's larger than a group, but just of our closest friends. You know, we always talk about fellowshipping. We don't mean that, you know, we should zero in and only talk and visit with people, certain ones. We want to talk and spread around to everybody. In smaller groups like we typically have right now, in the Church of God, a worldwide association, that's easier. Some of you may remember, as my wife and I do, congregations numbering into the hundreds. That was a little harder when we had a congregation, for example, in our last Canadian assignment that was pushing 400. In attendance. It's a little hard to do then. But we can do it well now. There's a type of growth, brethren. You know, the iron sharpens iron type of growth, Proverbs 27:17, that's only possible when we're a part of a body of believers, when we're a part of it. And that's good. And that's good. Christians are told they should resist pulling back. We're admonished to pull together. I'm reminded of words I read years ago by Ben Franklin, one of his autobiography. He said, "We must all hang together or we shall certainly hang separately." Written in the day when that was viewed as being treasonous. We're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. How many times have we read that in Hebrews 10? Sometimes people who have suffered personal disasters may be arguing for good reasons to pull back, but there's a danger in that. Paul wrote, we believe, if he wrote Hebrews, which we think is most likely, he wrote in Hebrews 10:39, "We are not of those who draw back to perdition, those who believe to the saving of the soul." Two more comparisons today. Laodicea and healthcare. I could have titled this Laodicea and HMOs. But the illustration, the third one I want to talk about is the eye salve thing in chapter 3 and verse 18. The Laodiceans' record of helping to restore health to eyes at the time, as much as they knew, it's not something terrible. It's to be complimented. But what about the spiritual application? Sometimes people who have helped others to see in a spiritual way can unwittingly begin to see themselves in that role too much, and they can take on a sense of self-sufficiency. Have you ever heard the phrase, and it's not to pick on the medical staff, we're talking about a medical illustration, you ever heard people say, "Doctors make the worst patients"? And sometimes those who work in healthcare may have run into that before, because they're so used to being the ones who have the answers and helping, and sometimes it's hard for them because they're also physical too, and that's not anything against them, it just happens. Sometimes you might even hear, well, how are teachers good students? Well, sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. But only if they're able to continue to receive teaching, to receive help. Remember how the Pharisees reacted to Jesus Christ's teaching? Why? What did they say? There was one exchange in John 9 where they said, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" Because they were thought to be the teachers in that society at that time. But that's not just to pick on the Pharisees. That could happen to anybody. Look at Romans chapter 2. Again, hold your place. Romans chapter 2. In verse 17. "Indeed, you who are called a Jew, and rest or rely on the law, and make your boast in God, and know His will, and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourselves are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law." That would be something they all would have thought of themselves. "You therefore, who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, 'Do not commit adultery,' do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written." And then he goes on to explain what is the most important factor. For in verse 28, he says, "He is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. Circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God." So the Laodicean HMOs created a problem for them. Their very ability with the medical understanding and practice of the time could lead to a certain view of themselves. Paul was very much aware of the need for self-discipline himself. He was a teacher of God's Word. What did he write? What is it he wrote in 1 Corinthians 9? He talked about, I keep myself under guard in one sense, lest after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. The old King James said, cast away. Well, that's something to be aware of for all of us, that even as we are sometimes able to be used by God to help others, are we always willing to be humble and teachable and learn? That was a message to Laodicea. Self-sufficiency is not a spiritual good quality. Even Jesus Christ himself said, "Of myself I can do nothing." That's our goal. That's our model. That's our guide. The last thing that I want to mention was the water supply. So now we've talked about, what have we got here? Laodicean money, Laodicean the clothing industry, or Laodicean designer apparel, Laodicean HMOs, and now we've got Laodicean utilities. So we really analyzed this whole society. That was their water supply. He says, "I know your works, that you're neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. Because you're lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth." That was a reference to the water supplies. We mentioned a little bit. It wasn't hot like the springs from Hierapolis. It wasn't cold, refreshingly cold like the waters of Colossae. Neither one of those applied. It was brought from a place called Denizli, about 6 miles away, and by the time it got there, wherever it started or whatever its temperature was to begin the trip, it was basically tepid or warmish, neither hot nor cold. Spiritually, that's a problem. Spiritually, that's a problem. And God, Jesus Christ inspired John to write, "Because you're neither one refreshingly cold or, you know, I guess you'd say, gut-warmingly hot. There are some days when just a cup of something hot to drink just feels really good, doesn't it? Especially in the wintertime. Maybe especially in the summertime, like for our friends in the Southern Hemisphere now. They just had a gathering in the International Leadership Program in New Zealand, and they all had suntans when I saw some of the pictures. Disgusting. I mean, it was nice for them. And they would have wanted a refreshing cold drink. But have you ever thought you were taking a sip of something just refreshingly cold and it wasn't? Have you ever thought you were going to take a sip of something nice and warm and hot, like a hot cup of tea or coffee or hot chocolate, and it was not? How does that sit with you? Not so well. What was Jesus Christ's solution for all of these problems? He loved these people. They were His people. They were His brothers and sisters. And He says, I counsel you to buy from Me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich spiritually. And white garments, symbolic of righteousness, not what it brought the wealth to Laodicea from their expertise in black wool. That the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. He focused on righteousness, not self-sufficiency. Righteousness that came from God and dependence on Him. Anoint your eyes with eye salve so that you can see. So you are alert spiritually. And all these things, He told them about the water temperature. He said, I wish you were one or the other. I wish you were cold or hot. Not halfway in between. And His rationale, what does He tell them about it? As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous and repent. The Laodiceans as a community and as a city, the establishment, the area, and it certainly impacted the brethren who lived there, they had extensive physical resources. They were spiritually bankrupt. Jesus Christ portrays Himself as someone standing outside their fellowship. In verse 20, I'm standing at the door and knocking. Let me into the room. And if anyone hears My voice and opens the door, I'll come in to him and dine with him. And he'll be with Me. Kind of a shocking thought. Christ excluded from a Church of God congregation. Fellowshipping with Him, like putting on bright clothing, is accomplished by fellowship with each other. 1 John 1, verse 3, the same one who physically wrote the book of Revelation wrote these words in 1 John 1, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you that you may have fellowship with us. Truly our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. So here's the question from today. What is Laodicean? Not who. We all have these tendencies, that's the point. It's a message to all the churches. What is Laodiceanism is clear. It's spiritual bankruptcy at the same time as you view yourself as spiritually rich. It's being spiritually able, you think, to teach others while not always yielding to being taught. It's thinking you are sufficient in your spiritual wardrobe when what we really need is to have the garments of righteousness from Jesus Christ's example. And in terms of the utilities, it's to be on fire when we need to be on fire. To not be lukewarm. In fact, he said it would even be preferable to be cold. There's a place for a cold, refreshing drink and a place for a hot, warming drink. Not so much for the one that's sort of in between. Spiritual independence is, to use that dictionary word, is an oxymoron. Spiritual independence is an oxymoron. If we're true servants of Jesus Christ, true Christians, we are interdependent. We rely on Him as our model and our guide, because His Father called us and drew us to follow that example, and we willingly and gladly associate with our brothers and sisters to build each other up as iron sharpening iron. I guess the best way to conclude is to read Jesus Christ's words that he inspired. "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches."